Good morning, Oregon. Thank you once again for loading me down and queuing me up. I'm Finn J.D. John, bringing you another daily episode of the Offbeat Oregon History Audio Edition podcast, which every weekday brings you another story from the archives of the Offbeat Oregon History syndicated newspaper column. You'll find the full details on that at offbeatoregon.com, our central webpage. Please do check it out. But first, sit back and relax and let me tell you about the Gallon House Bridge, which was ground zero in Oregon's battle over booze. Just before and during, and maybe a little bit after, Oregon decided that it was going to become a dry state. The bridge is a historic covered bridge in Marion County, halfway between a dry town called Silverton and a wet town called Mount Angel. And it became a meeting place for the thirsty, and also a symbol of Oregon's strange relationship with good old demon rum. This story was first published on April 24th, 2011, under the headline, Gallon House Covered Bridge, Ground Zero in the Battle Over Booze. Okay, here we go. If Oregon had ever had a civil war, it probably would have been over a bottle of scotch, and it probably would have broken out at the Gallon House Bridge in Marion County. The Gallon House was a covered bridge about halfway between Silverton and Mount Angel, deep in the heart of the Willamette Valley. When it was first built, the entire state of Oregon was dry, or rather, supposed to be. A state law promoted by Governor Oswald West, a teetotaling progressive with a friendly state legislature at his disposal, wrote into the state constitution that the, quote, manufacture, sale, or advertisement of intoxicating liquor would henceforth be verboten. In Silverton, the Protestant majority heartily approved, and a powerful temperance organization, the Good Templars, threw its weight behind the state law as well. But Mount Angel was not that kind of town. Founded by families from South Germany and Switzerland, it was as overwhelmingly Catholic as Silverton was overwhelmingly Protestant. Catholics, of course, took seriously the biblical injunction to take wine with communion, and they weren't going to, as they saw it, take Oz West's word over that of Jesus Christ. In this, they were joined by lots of non-Catholics who liked to drink once in a while and didn't appreciate the governor telling them they couldn't have one. So in much the same way that neighbors give each other packages of frozen Lockerbie stamped not to be sold, folks got around the law by giving each other spirits, hiding the money transfer that made it a sale rather than a gift. Although this was in utter violation of the spirit of state law, it was perfectly legal as long as nobody wrote out a receipt, or even if the receipt was for the bottle rather than its contents. This sort of thing would not wash in Silverton, where the municipal code got brave where state law got shy, but in Mount Angel, it worked fine. So Mount Angel bottle and jug merchants did a brisk trade taking care of thirsty visitors from Silverton. Most of these didn't make the 5-mile journey all the way to Mount Angel, though. Instead, they'd slip out of town on a back road that few traveled and go about 2 miles out of town to the Gallon House Bridge, a brand new, at the time, covered bridge across Abiqua Creek. On the Mount Angel side of the creek was a little shack, the Gallon House, at which a thirsty visitor could pick up a bottle or jug or fruit jar to add to his collection. Naturally, this caused some tension between the civic leaders of the two towns, although I haven't heard of any serious incidents having resulted. Perhaps that's because the federal government stepped in just a few years later with the Volstead Act, putting the entire country under prohibition and driving the whole liquor trade in both towns underground. This amusing little story says a lot about Oregon's odd relationship with alcohol since its founding. The state was home to the first brewery west of the Mississippi River, that would be Blitz Weinhard Brewery in Portland, established 1856. But downtown Portland restaurants seem to have eventually gotten a bit too diligent about supporting their local brewery. A half century later, in 1912, Portland industrialist Simon Benson noticed that the workers in his lumber mill were coming back from lunch slightly drunk because there was nothing non-alcoholic available in downtown Portland for them to drink. Well, anybody who's ever pulled green chain knows how exhausting that can be to work in a lumber mill. And in the summertime, workers have to guzzle quart after quart of liquids just to stay hydrated. One doesn't have to be an earnest teetotaler like Benson to see the problem with sawmill workers having to choose between A, debilitating and job-threatening dehydration, and B, coming back from lunch at a dangerous industrial job half drunk. Benson, when he learned about the problem, invested $10,000 to have water fountains installed all over Portland. These are the famous Benson Bubbler fountains, which are still in service today. There were other issues, too, not the least of which was the fact that right up until about 1910, it was very dangerous to get drunk in the presence of strangers in certain waterfront watering holes. You were likely to wake up with a lump on your head and a new job as a merchant mariner headed across the Pacific on a sailing ship to whose captain you had been delivered unconscious and wrapped in a tarp the night before by that very friendly stranger who was buying you drinks. And perhaps that's why West found the state so amenable to outlawing beer and liquor a couple of years later. All the really hard drinkers had lost fingers in a drunken sawmill accident or gotten deported by the Shanghai gangs or met some other similarly horrific fate, and no one was left behind to vote no. I say that with tongue firmly in cheek, but it may have actually been a factor. It's hard telling. Today, Oregon is widely thought of as the microbrewing movement's home state. By 1994, there was more brewing activity per person in Portland than anywhere else in the country, even Milwaukee and St. Louis, although that may have changed since Blitz Weinhard was sold and moved its operations out of town. Yet it's been a while since anyone's been shanghaied out of a waterfront bar or forced to choose between dehydration and drunkenness on the job. So it looks like when it comes to spirits, Oregon has finally found a good balance, or at least a path to sanity. Well, that's it for today's episode. If you're listening for the first time and want some more information about Offbeat Oregon history, you can get everything at our central website at offbeatoregon.com, the complete catalog of about 199 columns going back to 2008, plus links out to audio and text feeds on RSS and iTunes, and to the Facebook page and Twitter feeds. The websites are also where you'll find full citations to sources for this story, which include works by James Andrew Long, Ralph Friedman, and Lee Nelson. Our theme music is a track by the Atlas String Band, atlasstringband.com, written by Carmen Ficarra. Coming to Corvallis, drop me a line, let's grab a cup of coffee and talk history. I'm at Finn at offbeatoregon.com, or if you do Twitter, at offbeatoregon. Come to think of it, drop me a line anyway, even if you're not coming to Corvallis. I always love to hear from people who have similar interests to mine. This podcast is proudly part of the Creative Commons. The license is Attribution Share Alike, and for full details of that, see offbeatoregon.com/cc. That's it for today. Tomorrow I want to introduce you to, actually, the subject of my next book, but it's the unknown story of a president who grew up in Oregon and went on to save more people from starving to death than anyone else in the history of the world, with the possible exception of the guy who invented the Green Revolution, Norman Borlaug. I'm talking about Herbert Hoover, and you will not believe, unless you already know, what that guy actually did before he hauled off and ruined his reputation by getting himself elected president. So I'll have that story for you after about 6 o'clock tomorrow morning. And in the meantime, go fill up the rest of the day with good stuff. Bye now.